Today is Wednesday, June 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court issues a major win to the Trump administration's travel ban.
We have to make sure that we vet people coming into the country. We know who's coming in.
The president taunts Harley-Davidson motorcycles over plans to move overseas. An outcry after Iceland breaks international law on whaling. Also ahead, a 7-year-old becomes the youngest person in the world to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday upheld the Trump administration's travel restrictions on citizens of 5 majority Muslim countries, handing President Trump a victory in enforcing one of his most controversial policies. Trump called the ruling a tremendous victory for the American people and the Constitution.
The ruling shows that all of the attacks from the media and the Democrat politicians are wrong, and they turned out to be very wrong. And what we're looking for as Republicans, I can tell you, is strong borders, no crime. What the Democrats are looking at is open borders, which will bring tremendous crime.
VOA Justice correspondent Masood Farivar described to International Edition's Sarah Williams the significance of the decision.
Well, it depends who you talk to. You know, for the president and his administration, it is a major victory. You know, this is an outcome the president wanted to see all along after more than a year of court battles all over the country. The president sees this basically, the majority, as a victory for the American people and his national security agenda. Now, immigrant advocates and others clearly don't share that view. They see it as discriminatory and an affirmation of what they call a Muslim ban.
It was a narrow decision, you know, 5-4, like many Supreme Court, major Supreme Court cases have been recently. What did the majority cite as among the main reasons for upholding the travel ban?
Well, the case kind of basically centered on the president's authority, on presidential authority, and whether the president has the power under U.S. law to ban a certain class of foreigners from coming into the country. Now, under the 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, the president does have the power to restrict the entry of certain aliens that, quote, would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. That was the government's argument, and the 5 justices in the majority basically agreed with that argument. Another reason that they put forward was that the plaintiffs in the case, the state of Hawaii and the Muslim Association of Hawaii, failed to demonstrate that the travel ban violated the U.S. Constitution's Establishment Clause, which kind of bars favoring one religion over another. So there are 2 major reasons, but the main one centers on presidential authority.
But now, what did the minority opinion say about the travel ban?
The 4 justices in the minority wrote various scathing dissents in the case. They clearly did not agree with the court's ruling. One dissent kind of stood out, and that was written by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. And she said that she was troubled. She found troubling the parallels between the reasoning in this case and the infamous Korematsu v. United States case. And that was a 1944 Supreme Court ruling that affirmed the U.S. government's authority to put Japanese Americans in military internment camps during the war. So that was her opinion.
The nations that are included in the travel ban have changed over time. Why is that?
It's been really difficult to keep track of them, but initially back in January 2017, the president's travel ban included 7 Muslim countries. Then Iraq was dropped. And eventually, in the 3rd and current travel order, there are 5 Muslim countries, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, and also 2 other non-Muslim countries, North Korea and Venezuela. Now, North Korea and Venezuela were added, according to some observers, to make the ban more difficult to challenge as a Muslim ban. Chad was another country that had been added to the current order, but was recently dropped after the administration said that the Central African country complied with information sharing requirements.
What have civil rights groups and human rights organizations said?
They have strongly denounced it, but they're saying that they'll continue to fight. They haven't said how they're going to keep up the fight. Keep in mind that the Supreme Court ruling that was handed down today is now the law of the land. it effectively puts an end to the controversy over the travel ban. There are no additional legal recourses for opponents of this ban to turn to, but they have said that they will continue to fight.
All right, that was VOA Justice Correspondent Masood Farivar. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Former U.S. defense official says Google has stepped into a moral hazard. U.S. to world companies cut Iran oil imports or face sanctions. A deceased World War II soldier receives the highest military honor. And NATO may be close to adding a 30th member. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Harley-Davidson, the iconic motorcycle brand that sells its customers an image of freedom and adventure, found itself in an unwanted role this week, poster child for the damage of an international trade war. The company said it would move production bound for Europe overseas, blaming European Union tariffs, it said, would add to the average cost of a bike. Joining us for some perspective on this is Kenneth Reiner, director of the International Commerce and Policy Program at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. What do you make of the reaction to coming from the president, very angry about it?
Harley-Davidson is reacting to the incentives that President Trump has set up. President Trump has erected tariffs against the European Union. Everyone knew the European Union would respond in kind, that they would target certain sectors. We knew what those sectors were. They are doing so, and Harley-Davidson is a business, and they are making business decisions based on the presence of tariffs and trying to jump over tariffs to enter into a market through setting up production facilities. That is a international business strategy, very well known. So they're just doing what businesses do.
Do you think they will actually move, or do you think it's a threat?
That I don't know. You know, they have production facilities in other countries. The market in the European Union is rather large for motorcycles. So that would be a, you know, good reason to locate a production facility in the EU to serve that market. Multinational enterprises are always looking at market size and market growth. But, you know, I think only the executives at Harley-Davidson know for sure.
Do you think there's a possibility that other companies may make similar decisions given the situation with the tariffs?
It's always possible. Tariffs raise costs of production, and production can shift around globally in response. One thing that President Trump and his advisors do not seem to understand is that over the last couple decades, global production networks or value chains have distributed themselves across countries very widely. And sometimes to produce a final product, you're crossing not just multiple borders with intermediate parts and the like, but a single border more than once. And trade economists, such as myself, describe what President Trump is doing as, you know, building walls inside factories, because the factories are now distributed across countries. And for some reason, President Trump does not seem to appreciate that fact.
Overall, given the situation with the tariffs back and forth now and threats of more, how concerned are you about impacts to the U.S. economy and consumers?
I think there's reason to be concerned. It does not seem well thought out. There seems to be a lack of quality advisors with access to President Trump. Peter Navarro was brought on board because of his book, Death by China, but he's not a trade economist. He's not a trade policy expert. It's not the case, as Trump implied, that trade wars are always easy to win. We've seen these, you know, kinds of scenarios before. They're not good for business environments. Businesses like certainty, or at least, you know, the bounds within which they're going to be operating, and the way that the Trump administration is conducting trade policy is introducing a lot of uncertainty into the system, and that's of great cause for concern.
That's Kenneth Reinert, director of the International Commerce and Policy Program at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. The Iranian rial plunged to a record low against the U.S. dollar on the unofficial market Sunday, continuing its slide amid fears of returning U.S. sanctions after President Donald Trump in May withdrew a deal or from a deal on Tehran's nuclear program. The fall of the national currency has provoked a public outcry over the quick rise of prices of imported consumer goods. Merchants at the adjoining mobile phone shopping centers Aladdin and Sharsu in central Tehran protested against the rapid depreciation of the currency by shutting down their shops Sunday. A video posted on social media showed protesters marching and chanting, "Strike! Strike!" VOA's Victor Beatty asks Benham Ben Talibu with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies how serious Iran's economic situation really is.
I would say the economic situation in Iran is quite dire. The unofficial foreign exchange rate for the Iranian rial to the U.S. dollar is hovering just under 90,000. This is based on press reporting. But it's also important to note that market sentiment in Iran has been changing, not just as a result of the U.S. decision to pull out of the nuclear deal, which does damage to Rouhani's domestic brand at home and his promise of reintegrating Iran into the international economy, but also because of structural issues in the Iranian financial and particularly banking sector. Iran's oil sector remains outdated, and neither government seems to be interested, whether it's Rouhani, Ahmadinejad, or the administration before him, the reformist Khatami, of making the necessary sacrifices, updates, and changes to the Iranian economy. So it's an economy that doesn't want to change what makes it bad while seeking to get the benefits of what's actually good, meaning the integration into the international economy. And what happens is you have lots of classes suffering, you have a squeezed middle class, you have a dying private sector, and you have the bazaar, which led the strikes yesterday and today, gasping for life.
How likely are those protests to spread, to widen?
Well, already the protests which began outside the parliament building, which were again led by the merchant class, the bazaaris in Tehran, have spread to at least three other cities. And then today there are two other bazaars, one in the western city of Kermanshah, which is Kurdish heavy, that was shut down in solidarity with the strikes in Tehran, and part of the Isfahan bazaar is also mainly shuttered. So it is spreading, perhaps not at rapid fire speeds, but the sentiment is there.
Iran's judiciary chief warned on Tuesday that the economic saboteurs, as he called them, who he said were behind the fall of the currency, the rial, would face severe punishment, possibly execution or 20 years in jail.
Well, that's one of the most terrifying things about the Iranian political system is the lack of due process, as well as the lack of transparency and oversight. Some of these illicit exchange houses were actually supported by members of the government in Iran in 2017, which is, again, what helped precipitate part of the 2017-2018 protests that we saw in December of last year. Also, a lot of that loaded rhetoric from the judiciary in Tehran is replicating what we saw for most of the history of the Islamic Republic, which is to call segments of the Iranian population, foreign servants, foreign agents, spies, even outright, and then to use that loaded charge, unproven, to arrest them and then force them to confess to that loaded charge and then execute them and then use that execution, use that sentence as a deterrent to the rest of Iranian civil society and to the rest of Iranian society so as not to rise up. Terrifying cycle of violence and intimidation.
President Rouhani said the U.S. sanctions are part of a psychological, economic, and political war, adding that Washington will pay a high price for its actions. Is that an empty threat?
In some ways, yes, but in some ways, no. It's important to clarify the reason for the reinstation of the U.S. sanctions. Again, President Trump has long called the JCPOA nuclear deal a bad deal. I agree. He pulled out of the nuclear deal on May 8th, just a few days shy of the sanctions waiver deadline. I disagree with that method and manner in which the president withdrew from the deal. But ultimately, given that he fully withdrew and given that he desired to fully reimpose all nuclear sanctions on Iran, the U.S. has no option but to fully reinforce those sanctions. And it's not a campaign of psychological warfare. This is targeted financial warfare to get the regime to stop its bad behavior and to get the regime to reconsider that which has made and sustained it as an international pariah for almost four decades now. So Rouhani is looking, like many Iranian officials, to deflect blame outside. But what's been going on inside the country, evidenced by slogans chanted by bazaaris, who are of the traditional merchant class, who are favorable to the clergy in Iran, they have been chanting, at least on Monday, our problem, our enemy is not in America, it is here.
That's That's Benham Ben Talablu with the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia. Right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs, such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
VOA's International Edition continues. Conservation and animal protection organizations are alarmed by the slaughter last week of a 20-meter-long endangered fin whale by an Icelandic whaling company in defiance of the international ban on commercial whaling. The hunt is Iceland's first in 3 years and marks the start of a whaling season that could see as many as 238 of the majestic creatures killed. Residents of the island nation are divided over the issue. Joining us now to discuss is Kate O'Connell, marine wildlife consultant with the Animal Welfare Institute. How unusual is this slaughter?
It's unfortunately not unusual. Iceland resumed commercial whaling in 2006 for two different species. One is the endangered fin whale, and the other is the minke whale. The minke whale is a very small whale species. Hunts for the minke whale have been ongoing in every year since 2006. For fin whaling, the main whaling company, Kvaler, actually stopped whaling after the 2015 season, and so we were very hopeful that the company was not going to resume the hunt for this endangered animal. So when we discovered that indeed the boat had set out to go whaling and had landed an animal, we were deeply disappointed.
And this, as you said, is an endangered whale?
Yes. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is a scientific body that looks at all species around the world, has determined that the fin whale is an endangered species on a global level.
Has Iceland responded in any way to the outcry by environmental and animal organizations?
I think it's mixed. Whereas about 10 years ago, I think it would have been far more expected to get just a completely negative response to the calls by the environmentalists to stop whaling. I think we're seeing a real sea change in Iceland in the past few years. Whale watching has become much more important to the local economy, generates about $20 million a year in revenue for Iceland. And we're seeing a real shift in people's attitudes towards whaling. And a recent poll that was conducted just a few weeks ago within Iceland found the support for commercial whaling within the country at its lowest level ever. Only about a third of Icelanders actually support the resumption of the hunt for fin whale.
I was in Iceland a few years ago, and it really struck me to see by the harbor there in Reykjavik, you have the whale watching boats right next to the whale hunting ship. And I remember talking to people about how you could be out on a whale watching trip and you're going out to see living whales, of course, and end up potentially seeing something like that would be pretty, I would think, pretty traumatic.
It was. In 2015, there was actually an incident where a tourist was out on a whale-watching vessel and had a wonderful trip, saw many different species of whales. And as the whale-watching vessel was coming back to the docks in Reykjavik, lo and behold, there appeared one of the Kvaler whaling boats dragging two dead fin whales. And the response from the people on board was just utter horror and a recognition that it really has come down to the point now where Iceland needs to choose whaling or whale watching. And obviously, if you're thinking in terms of the economy, whale watching generates so much more money for all Icelanders, whereas whaling really is benefiting only a very few people within Iceland.
I also noticed when I was there that many of the restaurants, actually, which was, it was shocking as an American to see something like that, but on menus, the minke whale on the menu.
It is deeply upsetting, and I think one of the good stories to come out of Iceland recently in terms of the consumption of whale meat is that consuming whale meat has actually dropped in Iceland significantly, including for tourists. There's a wonderful program that's run by a group called Ice Whale, which is the organization of Icelandic whale watching vessels, and they've been promoting this program called Meet Us, Don't Eat Us since 2009. And when they first began, over 40% of tourists polled said, yeah, sure, I'll try whale meat. I have no problem with it. But through this long-term education program and doing outreach on the whale watching vessel, talking with people in the street, putting out local ads, getting local Icelandic folk people come up and say, we don't eat whale meat. Why should you eat whale meat in Iceland? That figure has dropped from 40% down to about 11% in the most recent poll.
Is there any repercussion for Iceland as far as this being in defiance of the international ban on commercial whaling?
They have been under review by the U.S. government under the Obama administration. There had been a decision to do something called a certification of Iceland, in which it was found that, yes, indeed, Iceland is defying both the International Whaling Commission ban on whaling and also the CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade and Endangered Species ban on trade in whale products. And through that certification, the president at that time made the decision that Iceland would experience very strong diplomatic sanctions. So Iceland was not invited to a very important oceans conference that was hosted by the U.S. Every time that U.S. officials met with their Icelandic counterpart, they would raise the issue of whaling and trade in whale products. Also, within the European Union, there was the drafting of a very strong political statement called a demarche, which is a diplomatic protest, and that was sent to Iceland. And so there's been quite a lot of high-level political pressure brought against the country, but also what we're increasingly seeing are a lot of people questioning, is this now the time for me to say, will I keep visiting Iceland to do whale watching? And, you know, as I stated previously, maybe now is the time for Iceland to make its own determination that whale watching definitely is more important to the country and its future and its image than whaling.
All right. Kate O'Connell, marine wildlife consultant with the Animal Welfare Institute. Thank you for being with us. At an age when most kids were mastering skills like math and reading, 7-year-old Montana Kenny was becoming the youngest person in the world to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. She summited Africa's highest peak with her mother over spring break from school this March. Faiza Al-Masri caught up with Montana and her mother, Holly Kenny, and has their story narrated by Faith Lapidus.
At 5,895 meters, Mount Kilimanjaro is one of the highest peaks in the world. Reaching the summit was quite an adventure for 7-year-old Montana Kenny of Austin, Texas. The quest started about 2 years ago when her mother, Holly Kenny, decided to climb the mountain in Tanzania.
My sister had asked me if I was interested in climbing Mount Kilimanjaro with her. And when we started the planning phase, she had backed out of it and she decided she didn't want to go anymore. And then I had been asking a couple friends if they were interested in going, and Montana chimed in. She said, I want to do it with you, Mommy.
Montana wanted to set a new record and, more importantly, pay tribute to her father, who'd passed away when she was 3.
I knew that heaven was not that much farther up from Mount Kilimanjaro, so I wanted to do it.
It took 6 days to reach the peak.
It was pretty warm at the bottom, but it was pretty cold at the very, very, very top.
Montana's mother says it took months for them to get ready for the trip.
I'm an endurance athlete, so it wasn't foreign to me to do something like this. And both of us are swimmers, so she was in good shape to begin with, and she's also a triathlete. We started doing a lot of back-to-back hiking. So fortunately, in the Austin, Texas area, we've got a couple big hills that we could go up and down and up and down to get our hip flexors and muscles ready for the bigger challenge.
Getting ready for the big challenge also meant packing appropriate clothing, researching the mountain and Tanzania, and worrying about altitude sickness.
Yeah, I definitely had a lot of anxiety about altitude sickness. I did not want to risk my daughter. I didn't want her to be at risk. And what they kept saying was everybody gets altitude sickness.
That's a combination of symptoms ranging from headache, dizziness and nausea to loss of energy and shortness of breath triggered by the decrease of oxygen at high altitudes.
We had made the decision that even if she showed the slightest sign of altitude sickness, we were going to turn around. We were not going to go. So I was almost certain we weren't going to make it, but we did, and my daughter didn't have any issues.
But mother and daughter were nervous the night before their guide was to help them reach the summit.
We didn't get any sleep. That was very challenging because she just wanted to lay down and go to sleep. And then to take 7.5 hours to reach the summit. And then when we finally get there, we have to come back down, which was another 3 hours. And then we had lunch and then spent another 5.5 hours going down even further. So it was 17 hours total that we were hiking. It was extremely exciting. And to see Montana blow kisses to her daddy and to know that she was as close as she possibly could be to him in heaven, that was really just something that was very meaningful for a mom to see.
In addition to the accomplishment of reaching the top of Kilimanjaro and setting a world record, the trip was an introduction to new cultures.
Not only did we try different foods when we were on the mountain, but we went on 2 safaris. We stopped in one of the towns to see how the people in Tanzania live. And we went to their local markets. We met several business owners. We met several families. And that was really exciting. And the kids that lived in the towns absolutely loved meeting my daughter. That was a lot of fun.
And Montana learned that with determination and hard work, she can achieve whatever she sets her mind to. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And thanks for listening to International Edition. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past 5 years, the Feed the Future Nigeria Livelihoods Project has helped pull some of the most vulnerable families in Nigeria out of poverty. This U.S. government foreign assistance program has helped Nigerians improve agricultural production, income generation, nutrition, and sanitation. The $22.6 million program in Nigeria began in 2013 and concluded just last month. Administered by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and implemented by Catholic Relief Services, the program initially helped 42,000 poor households in Abuja, Nigeria's capital, Kebbi, and Sokoto states to increase agricultural production, diversify incomes, and improve nutrition. It also provided livelihoods planning skills, adult literacy and numeracy instruction, and cash transfers to the most vulnerable households. In 2017, the program expanded to Adamawa, Borno, and Yobe states, reaching 10,000 more households. This project took a holistic approach to agriculture, to livelihoods, and to social development, said USAID Mission Director Stephen Hagen. It addressed the needs of the extreme poor by improving incomes and reducing vulnerabilities, and in this way serving as a model for efforts to build resilience in rural Nigeria. The USAID program introduced new technology, improving agricultural production and access to input markets such as quality seeds for smallholder farmers. As a result, crop yields doubled for more than 33,000 farmers. The program also helped farmers to reduce post-harvest losses. The activity engaged poor households in the rural economy by providing business skills and financial literacy support, vocational trainings and lending schemes, and safe spaces for adolescent girls. Additionally, more than 2,000 community workers were trained to deliver over 1.5 million counseling and group sessions on nutrition that led to a 22% drop in stunting, 10% drop in wasting, and 53% increase in exclusive breastfeeding rates in targeted locations. A cash transfer component alone helped lift 2,740 households out of poverty. State and local governments have shown positive support towards sustaining the gains from the program. The U.S. is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to improve the lives of the Nigerian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.